All right, welcome to today's Wednesday afternoon lecture series. On behalf of the Trafficking Interest Group here at NIH, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ana Maria Cuervo from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Ana Maria got her MD and PhD degrees at the University of Valencia in Spain, and after that she came to Tufts, where she worked with Paulo Dice, and that's where she got very interested in the general problem of protein degradation, how are proteins in the cell degraded. And in particular, she started work on a very poorly understood mechanism of protein degradation where proteins in the cytosol are selectively degraded in lysosomes. And this process, which we now know as chaperone-mediated autophagy, is really the topic that Ana Maria has studied for the past probably about 15 years or so. And in that time, she's really made some amazing contributions to our understanding of this process that she'll tell you about in two really broad areas. One is just the mechanism of how this process actually works. And the second, which I think will be interesting to all of us eventually, is the relationship of this process to aging and neurodegeneration. And for this work that Ana Maria continues to really make important contributions to, she has been recognized with numerous awards. Most recently, she was named a 2008 Keith Porter Fellow in Cell Biology. And it's my pleasure to have her talk about her work here today. Ana Maria.
Well, thank you so much, Manu. It's a real pleasure. Can I stay outside of the podium or no? Okay, because this is too high for me. Yeah, but it's a real, real pleasure to be here today and to have the opportunity of chatting with our friends and seeing so many people that I know. And I have a terrific day with the fellows and discussing. But they didn't tell me till yesterday that this was such a big auditorium, so I will try to go slow, and please stop me if at any point that there is any question. I try to speak a little fast. I'm going to try to go slow, but just stop me any time. So as Manu mentioned, our interest is mostly on cleaning cells and handling altered proteins from the point of view of protein degradation. So as all of you know, when you have a protein that misbehaves, gets damaged, for any reason, you have a mechanism in the cells that are going to take care of that protein. So you have chaperones, and the chaperones and the repairing enzymes are going to try to repair this protein. And if that's possible, basically you have your protein repaired and nothing happens. But sometimes what happens is that the level of damage is such that refolding or repair is not possible, or just the conditions of the cell at that particular time are not ideal for this repair. So then the chaperones are going to send these proteins to degradation. And it's really more recycling. It's not destruction, because then you can use the amino acids for the synthesis of new proteins. So it's kind of a recycling mechanism that is very efficient. So these two systems, the chaperones and the proteases, are in place and function in all the cells and in all functional organs. But as you get old, and in some particular diseases, what happens is that the ability to clear up these proteins that you cannot repair seems to be somehow hampered, and then those proteins start accumulating in the cytosol, you start bringing other proteins, and then you end forming these aggregates. And I have to say, when I use the term aggregates, it's in a very loose way. Anything that is not soluble anymore, that has a irreversible conformation, is what I will be referring as aggregate. But the idea is that you have these non-functional structures, and what we are really interested is trying to understand why these proteolytic systems that normally take care of the removal of those proteins do not function in all these settings, in aging and some particular diseases. So, as you know, in the cells, there are different proteolytic systems that can be utilized for the removal of those damaged proteins. One of them that all of you know very well is the ubiquitin proteasome system. That is a very selective mechanism by which you can pinpoint proteins and send them for degradation through this complex. But then in addition, as you know, you have a whole organelle that is devoted to degradation, and these are the lysosomes. So the lysosomes have the beauty that in addition of soluble proteins, they can also internalize whole organelles if you have a mitochondria that is damaged or any other component, but also proteins that aggregate in non-functional way, in aggregates. And this whole process of degradation of intracellular components in lysosomes is what was called for a long time autophagy, or eating yourself. So I'm not going to be talking much about the protest on event. We do things on the side, and I'm going to be mostly focused all my comments today about autophagy. So what I thought is that I will give you just a very brief about the different autophagy pathways, to then focus in the pathway that we are mostly interested, that is the chaperone-mediated autophagy. And then, depending on how we do on time, I will talk a little about our current work in the effect of aging in the activity of these systems. So going into the autophagy mechanism, basically, autophagy in general plays two major roles inside the cell. For once, it's going to provide energy. As I mentioned, you can obtain amino acids, fatty acids, all these building blocks by degradation of intracellular components. And this is very often used, for example, during starvation or nutritional deprivation. You can get your energy out of your own components inside the cell. But in addition, as I mentioned, the other major role is this quality control. Autophagy in its different flavors is going to be used to remove altered proteins, organelles, or any kind of a structure that might accumulate in the cell. And there is growing evidence that when you block different types of autophagy, basically you start altering cellular homeostasis, you start accumulating proteins that are damaged or altered, you don't turn over your organelles as often as you should, and eventually this leads very often to cellular death and loss of function of a particular organ. So there are different ways or different types of autophagy, and they basically differ on how you take something from the cytosol and get it into the lysosome. So the one that is better characterized, and I'm pretty sure many people in the room works on this one, is macroautophagy, in which you take a whole region of the cytosol, so you form this limiting membrane, and it's going to sequester a whole region of the cytosol, including not only soluble proteins, but also organelles, and this is my poor representation of a mitochondria. You form this vesicle, and this double membrane vesicle still does not have enzymes. So in order to degrade what you have just sequestered, this vesicle fused with the lysosome, and then these components are degraded. And as I say, this is macroautophagy. A similar process of sequestration of a whole region of the cytosol takes place in microautophagy. But in this case, it's the lysosomal membrane itself, the one that invaginates or protrudes and sequesters a region of the cytosol that gets internalized in single membrane vesicles that then are rapidly degraded. So these two processes, microautophagy and macroautophagy, sequester, as I mentioned, regions of the cytosol. But then you also have the possibility of sending proteins that are soluble in the cytosol one by one across the membrane into the lysosome. And this pathway is the one known as chaperone-mediated autophagy that I will be mostly focusing later on. So just to show you how these pathways compare, and I say this is work in progress because fortunately for us, the field of autophagy has really exploded and there is new information coming every day. But the classical idea is that this will be the three basic pathways that you have in mammalian cells. And then the whole concept was that microautophagy, that is still very poorly characterized, is a constitutive mechanism. This is the one that is continuously functioning in the cell. Meanwhile, these two forms, macro and CMA, chaperone-mediated, are inducible. But as you can see here, we already start to modulate in because there is very nice work coming from many different labs showing the existence of a basal level of macroautophagy that is essential for cellular homeostasis. And we also have good evidence of chaperone-mediated autophagy, depending on the tissue, having also a very important basal level. The other way that they differ is regarding the mechanism of translocation. As I mentioned, in microautophagy and macroautophagy, you form vesicles. You need some membrane conformational change, either in the surface of the lysosome or outside in the cytosol and then fusing. Meanwhile, here, as we will see later on, this just requires direct transport. You don't need the membrane to deform in any particular way. They also, due to this mechanism of translocation, the substrates are going to be different. You can degrade proteins and organelles through these two pathways because they can just get the whole region of the cytosol. Meanwhile, here you only degrade soluble proteins. And then the beauty of what we think that is interesting of chaperone-mediated is the selectivity. So it is considered that microautophagy will not be very selective, And then for macroautophagy, I put a question mark because it's become clear that it's selective. It can discriminate between a mitochondria that is damaged or not, or a peroxisome, or a particular aggregate, but there is so far not any evidence that it can discriminate in between individual soluble proteins. So as far as you have something organized or in a form of a particle, you can discriminate. As a soluble component, there is not selectivity. And the selectivity as a soluble protein is only a time to go to the lysosomes through chaperone-mediated autophagy. So moving a little more in this pathway that, as Manu mentioned, is the one that we've been mostly interested for all these years, this mechanism of degradation was really described by Fred Dyes and by Erwin Neck, and I was the lucky graduate student crossing from Valencia to Boston to figure out if it was the same pathway, and then my group has contributed some of these findings too. But what we learn is that there is a subset of cytosolic proteins that all of them contain a targeting motif, this pentapeptide, and when this motif gets exposed, those proteins are going to be recognized by chaperones and co-chaperones in the cytosol. And the chaperone that recognizes directly the motif is this constitutive member of the HSP70 family, HSC70. And once this complex is formed, by a mechanism that we still don't understand clearly, this complex is now directed to the lysosomal membrane. And several years ago, we identified that in the membrane, there is a receptor protein, this lysosomal associated membrane protein, type 2A or LAMP2A, and this is kind of a docking station. You have your protein coming with the chaperone and just binds to this cytosolic tail of this chaperone. Then the substrate undergoes unfolding, and unfolding is required for translocation. And once this unfolds, you have another chaperone located in the lumen that is going to pull your substrate, this blue protein, inside and gets completely degraded. So with the time, we have developed assays that allow us to analyze the interaction of the chaperones with the substrate, the binding to the membrane, the translocation, and the degradation in the lumen. And what we have learned is that this is a very generalized mechanism of protein degradation that is present in all kinds of tissues, but the activity depends on the cell type and also on the cellular conditions. And the conditions that result in maximal activation of this pathway is normally stress conditions. So we've been characterizing the nutrient deprivation for quite a while, but now we have also evidence that other conditions resulting in cellular damage, damage of soluble proteins such as oxidation, or exposure to different toxic compounds that denature proteins, also result in upregulation of this pathway. When this pathway is upregulated, the proteins degraded are those ones that contain this motif that just by sequence analysis is about 30% of the proteins in the cytosol. Having said that, this means that 30% could be candidates for degradation, but it doesn't mean that they are continuously going through this pathway, as they have to really expose the motif and be recognized by the chaperones. And then in recent years, we've been very interested in trying to identify conditions in which the activity of this pathway change, because we think that that will give us insights about what could be the physiological role of this pathway. So we've been looking at different pathologies, and what we have found is that there are different kind of kidney disorders associated to protein damage, or for example, in galactosialidosis, a lysosomal storage disorder, that the activity of this pathway is upregulated. Meanwhile, in other conditions, such as in aging, and some familiar forms of Parkinson's disease that I will tell you later on, the activity of this pathway decreases. And we've been using some of these models to understand a little more about the physiology of this pathway. So regarding the components, the chaperones are interacting in the cytosol, and our focus has been mostly in the lysosomal membrane components. And in this one is critical, the presence of this LAMP2 receptor. So as I mentioned, and you probably have here a lot of LAMPs being here, but basically this is the lysosomal membrane. LAMPs are single transmembrane proteins with a short cytosolic tail, and they are heavily glycosylated, so most of the protein is in the lumen. So in the case of LAMP2, this is just a splice variant, the LAMP2A, of a single gene. So the gene can undergo alternative splicing that has identical luminal region, but then the transmembrane and the cytosol are encoded by different exons. So you can have A, B, or C. And what we have found is that LAMP2A, the cytosolic tail of LAMP2A, and this is the composition, is the specific for this pathway. So we did that of different ways, but for example, if we use peptides that reproduce this tail, we can compete with the pathway. or we have also developed antibodies that recognize each of the tails. So if we put an antibody that blocks this cytosolic tail, so imagine we take our lysosomes, we incubate with the antibody, and now we present a substrate. So ribonuclease A is one of the cytosolic substrates that we use often, and then we try to analyze what happened to the binding and translocation. So basically, when you put increasing amounts of this antibody coating your lysosomes, you have a clear decrease in the levels of the substrate that now can't go in. And if you put a premium, or for example, LAMP2B or LAMP2C antibodies, you don't get any effect. But just to confirm that LAMP2A, the present, was essential for translocation, recently, Ashish Masi, a graduate student in the lab, used RNA interference to eliminate this particular variant. So LAMP2B and C are still there, and he was just eliminating LAMP2A. So when we isolate those lysosomes, these are regular lysosomes, and these are levels of LAMP2A in three different clones. And when you assay how good are they for transport of substrates, as you can see here, this is the transport in the wild type, and this is in the other clones, and they correlate very well with the amount of LAMP2 that you have left in your lysosomes. So basically, this supports that LAMP2 is essential for this translocation. So I don't want to give you all the details, but one of the things that we've been working very recently is trying to figure out how translocation happens. I mean, we thought when we isolate this receptor, it was going to be very easy. We were going to pull down and get all these gorgeous transporters and things like that. So that didn't happen. But then Urmi Bandopadhyay, another graduate student in the lab, in collaboration with Louis Babatkowski here in the NCI, we've been trying to characterize the dynamics of this protein. And what she has found is that, as I mentioned, when you have, this is the lysosomal membrane, and the chaperone is going to bring the substrate, but the substrates bind to monomers of this LAMP2, this docking protein that I mentioned. As the substrates bind, this promotes multimerization, and we have found that for the stability of this transition from monomers to multimers, a form of HSP90 present in the lumen of the lysosomes is essential, because if not, the complex destabilizes. Sorry. And then you have the translocation channel that basically only occurs when you have this multimerization. So basically you need a symbol of this receptor in order to form this 700 kilodalton complex. But then the interesting thing is that if you present only the chaperone, so if you don't put substrates, HSC70 is able to dissociate this complex and make it again as monomers. And this seems to be essential because we've proved that binding does not occur in the complex, but binding only occurs when the protein is a monomer. So somehow you have this continuous process of assembly and deassembly that will allow continuous cycles of binding and uptake. And we think that this probably, we don't know the exact reason why, but our speculation is that you have this compartment that is acidic and it's very nasty. It has all these very proteases that can degrade things. So it's probably not very smart to have a whole transporter very stable there, because if things go wrong, your proteases can go to the cytosol, and besides, will make more difficult to maintain the pH. So the transient nature of this complex, it might have a protective function that you only form it, get the translocation, and then the assembly, and it also allows an extra level of regulation on this process, because we have, for example, some LAMP2s that we prevent multimerization. We identify the multimerization region. So if they cannot multimerize, they bind, but they will never translocate. So formation of this complex is essential. And then the other level of organization in the surface of the lysosomes is regarding the regions in the membrane. So Susmita Kosik in the lab, she is a graduate student that showed that in the lysosomal membrane, there are particular lipid microdomains. So there are areas that are enriching cholesterol and particular gangliosides. And what she found is that LAMP2 has to go to those regions in order to get cleaved. So basically, the turnover of this receptor requires the association to these microdomains. Then the cathepsins, and this is a dual cleavage, arise, and then you degrade your receptor. And this is a way which you can continuously renew the LAMP2A that you have in the lysosomal membrane. When you have conditions with very low activity of this pathway, basically this recycling, this degradation of LAMP2A is enhanced, and you basically have very few molecules exposed in the cytosolic tail. Whenever you enhance the activity of this pathway, rather than the novel synthesis of the receptor, In many of the cases, what happens is that the protein gets out of the microdomains and forms these multimers. And as I mentioned, these multimers are the ones that are going to allow the translocation. So right now we are very interested in trying to figure out how different changes in the lipid composition of the lysosomal membrane can modify the activity of this pathway. And I will give you some insights of some of the aging studies on this respect. So then the other thing that we've been very interested is in look for new substrates. So we have a list of about like 30 substrates that has been validated experimentally as substrates of this pathway. And from time to time, we came across with some groups of proteins that are particularly exciting. So a couple of years ago, we started analyzing sequence of proteins that are known to misbehave, to participate in these disorders that involve protein misfolding. And we thought it would be interesting to know if those proteins somehow can be removed by CMA. So for example, all of you know about synuclein and its role in Parkinson's disease, APP in Alzheimer's, or Huntington in Huntington. And when we look through the sequence, all of them contain motifs that make them possible candidates for degradation through this pathway. And it was known that there is problems with the handling of these proteins. So Marta Martinez, a postdoctoral fellow in the lab, in collaboration with the groups of Salzer and Petrovsky in Columbia, Harry in UPenn, and Peter in Harvard, we decided to analyze whether alpha-synuclein was a substrate for this pathway in any condition, and what happened during the disease. I mean, when you have these modified forms of alpha-synuclein, if they can still go through this pathway. So I'm not going to give you all the data, but basically what we found is that when you take wild-type alpha-synuclein, there is always a percent that it can go through the lysosome. So if we quantify, you have part of this alpha-synuclein binds and part translocate across the membrane, and it's actually a pretty good substrate. If you compare with other substrates that we have, translocation of alpha-synuclein is very efficient. But then the interesting thing is that when we use the two mutants that were described by them and also modify forms of synuclein, for example, these dopamine-modified adults, and we present it to these lysosomes, what we found is that these proteins bind to the lysosomal membrane, and you can see it here. I mean, this is very high binding affinity, but they never translocate. When you look at your lysosomes, we have four different assays for translocation, and you find them bind to the membrane but never cross inside. So one thing that we were very worried was this very high binding affinity, because all of a sudden you have these proteins completely stuck in the surface of your lysosomes. So we were able to report that the presence of these abnormal proteins in the surface of the lysosomes really prevent the functioning of this pathway. So now you are not able to remove the proteins. So basically, our interest right now is trying to figure out why these proteins get stuck, and we have some interesting data of oligomerization in relation with these lipid microdomains that I mentioned. But the whole working model is that while alpha-synuclein, when it's in solution, can be degraded by the proteasome or by chaperone-mediated autophagy, when you have this modified alpha-synuclein, and as I say, initially we thought it was only the mutants, but then Marta showed that when you go through all the different post-translational modifications, there was one, the dopamine-react alpha-synuclein, that presented similar phenotype. Basically, these proteins go to the lysosomal membrane, get stuck in this membrane, and then eventually they accumulate in the cytosol. But because these lysosomes are completely decorated with these abnormal proteins, other proteins cannot go through, and eventually they might also contribute to this. So the whole idea is that when we isolate the lysosomes from the different models, they were not functional for chaperone-mediated. So we become interested in trying to figure out what would be the consequences of having this blockage in this pathway. So the consequences of failure we have studied at different levels, and one of the first things that we look was at the levels of oxidized proteins, because even oxidized proteins are a good candidate for degradation by the proteasome. As any other protein, they can go different pathways. So Roberta Kiffin in the lab showed some years ago that if you oxidize any of these candidate substrates that we have in the cytosol, they become beta substrates, probably because some level of unfolding exposes the motif that is going to be recognized by the chaperone so they can target beta. But the interesting thing is that in addition of this effect in the substrates that make them more amenable for recognition by the chaperones, a very exciting thing is that when we isolate lysosomes from those animals or those cells that has been exposed to oxidative stress, and now we just present regular substrates. They are much better in translocating. And Roberta was able to show that what happened is that you increase the formation of these multimeric units because you increase the levels of your receptor. And in this case, this is the only case that is transcriptional. So when you have oxidative stress, most of the cells upregulate the expression of this receptor to contribute to the removal of these proteins. But then, just to get a more broad idea, so our idea is that is in the Parkinson model, we have this blockage of chaperone-mediated. This might contribute to the accumulation of oxidized proteins in the cytosol that is characteristic of the affected neurons. But then we decide to do it more global and say, okay, let's block this pathway in normal cells and see what happens. So Ashish used the model that I mentioned before, basically RNA interference against the receptor, so you don't have LAMP2A. And then among the different things that he found is that when you block this pathway, this chaperone-mediated, you upregulate macroautophagy. This other pathway that, as I mentioned, requires the formation of these vesicles, autophagosomes, fusion, and degradation. And we can report that by different ways. The favorite one these days is using this LC3 protein that is a protein that decorates the autophagosomes. So basically you look for fluorescent panta, and then you identify this structure. So when you compare, these are normal cells that have chaperone-mediated, you hardly see any of these autophagosomes. When you block this pathway, you start to see this panta, that then when you do microscopy, you really see that there are autophagolysosomes and that they are really sequestering and degrading the cytosol. So that was okay, even was a little disappointed because, we always thought that this pathway was so special, and all of a sudden we blocked this pathway that I mentioned is very selective, and we thought that this was something important, and basically the cells just switch into a different mode. They activate this pathway that might be less selective but has higher capability. And then when you look at the cells were okay. They were growing a little slower, but nothing major. So, of course, she's entering major depression here, and we start trying to figure out what was wrong. I mean, we have to figure out when you need this pathway. So what we realize is that all our assays were done in basal conditions. But I make the point that you really utilize this chaperone-mediated under stress. So then we decide, okay, let's challenge these cells and see if they are so fine as they seem when they have only this pathway but not this. So what we did that. So these are control cells. And basically, we use different challenge. We did oxidative stress. This is, for example, H2O2, paraquat, cadmium. We did UV, heat shock. And this is the viability of regular cells. So this is the number of viable cells. And then when you compare cells in orange that do not have this pathway, even they have perfect macroautophagy, they do not do so good. Basically, the viability decreases. And when you measure apoptosis, you have higher rates of apoptosis, and these cells are dying. Even macroautophagy is perfect. So this gave us the idea that the selectivity of this pathway is important under these stress conditions, and that even if you upregulate this other pathway that has very high capability, losing the selectivity might be detrimental for the cells, and actually they eventually die. So going back to the whole idea of this blockage of CMA that we observe because of the modified synucleins, we think that in addition of contribute to the impaired elimination of oxidized protein, it might also contribute to the regulation of the response to stress. And then when these neurons are stressed by different conditions, they eventually will lead to cell death just because this pathway is not functioning anymore. So one of the things that we learned through those studies is that there was some level of crosstalk between different forms of autophagy. As I mentioned, when we block chaperone-mediated, we found that macroautophagy was upregulated. And early this year, Susmita showed, that the opposite is true. When you block macroautophagy, chaperone-mediated is now upregulated, and we have some evidence linking also with the proteasome. And Ronco Pito showed if you block the proteasome, macro gets upregulated. And I really think that the number of arrows is going to keep growing and increasing the complexity because, in addition, this crosstalk between pathways might be different depending on the cell type and also depending on the cellular conditions when it happens. But the beauty of this is that I think, thinking more in therapeutics and how to manipulate these systems, the idea is that if you have a failure in a pathway, you still have a chance to modulate the other and be able to compensate, at least under basal conditions. So this is something that we've been exploring during the last years. So, for example, to give you an idea, in this Parkinson model that we were discussing, so normally if this is alpha-synuclein, and as I mentioned, it can go through the proteasome or through CMA, then when you start having the modified proteins, eventually the abnormal proteins are going to decrease the activity of CMA, and then you have this upregulation of macro. And the same thing, when you block the proteasome, basically you have upregulation of macro. So all of a sudden, you enter in this compensatory stage that the neurons or the cells are fine because they don't have the other pathways 100% working, but they have upregulated macroautophagy that under basal conditions, it seems to maintain this pathway. And this whole idea of the upregulation of macroautophagy in the context of proteins that tend to form these aggregates of these oligomeric structures, it was also very exciting because it has been shown in the field that macroautophagy might be very important for the removal of aggregate proteins. So, for example, when you have an aggregate, a protein that is not soluble anymore, these aggregates can be selectively recognized by autophagosomes and basically get eliminated. So he gave this idea that therapeutically, when you think about all those diseases in which you have accumulation of aggregates, it will make sense to upregulate macroautophagy and get rid of them. So as I mentioned, that there were a couple of trials and some assays for the group of Rubinstein that were citing on the idea that using Huntington models, if they upregulate macroautophagy for a brief period of time, they can get rid of some of these aggregates and probably oligomers that were not followed by them, and improve functional conditions. But one piece of limitation on this aspect, two pieces of limitation, is that we have recently found that not all the aggregates are the same. So one of the things that we've been looking, and this is all work by Esther Wong, a postdoctoral fellow in the lab, in collaborations with the lab of Lim and Dawson, and Esther have a very simple question, that is whether each time that you form an aggregate in a cell, macroautophagy is gonna go for it and get rid of it. So Esther used a very simple model that has been validated by many groups. For example, in this case, she was using Huntington, that, as you know, is a protein that tends to form aggregates. So she identified these are classical aggregosomes, as Ron Copito defined them. So they have GABA tubulin, they follow all the markers, and if you put nocodazole, this big aggregate now dissipates. So basically, she was following the degradation of those aggregates. And for example, what she was doing is stimulating autophagy through starvation. So, for example, if she starts with 100% aggregates and then she activates macroautophagy, she gets rid of some of these aggregates. The same thing if she uses a chemical, rapamycin, to activate macroautophagy, you can get rid of these aggregates. But then if you, for example, block macroautophagy, there is not clearance even you do starvation. And then just to completely validate that this was going through macroautophagy, she knocked down one of the essential genes required for formation of autophagosomes, and in that case, it doesn't matter that you starve your cells, the aggregates just remain there. So using this very simple model, what she tried to address is whether the nature of the aggregate, the protein that is aggregated, matter or not. So I'm just going to show you some here. She has a million of these guys. But basically, this is studies with Huntington, synuclein, synfilin, P38, and desmin. So these are proteins all that are known to aggregate in different diseases. And her question was the same. Do these aggregates get removed? So as I mentioned, the same way that she found for Huntington, when she follows alpha-synuclein aggregates, if she does a starvation, they go down, and rapamycin also get rid of them. But then the interesting thing, when she did P38, so basically this suggests that the aggregate is recognized by the autophagy machinery and get rid of it. When she does P38 or desmin, it doesn't matter how much she activates the autophagy pathway, and the autophagy pathway is fine. I mean, we verified that when you do these treatments, you really have autophagosomes going. But somehow, these autophagosomes are not recognizing the aggregates, suggesting that these aggregates are of different nature or somehow they are not seen. But just as a note of hope, she also did the combine. She took alpha-synuclein, put it with P38, so now she has these mixed aggregates, and then they get removed, suggesting that whatever synuclein is bringing to the game to attract the lysosomes can also do it with a protein that normally does not have this marker. So currently she's trying to dissect which parts of the molecules are the ones important to interact with the autophagy machinery and did the degradation. But I think that as a note of caution, the idea is that not all the aggregates are going to be removed when we upregulate macroautophagy. And then the other thing about the idea of just upregulating macroautophagy as treatment is that I think it's also very important to think that upregulation is not always going to be the answer. Just as an example of what I mean by this, I'm just going to present briefly some work that we have done in Alzheimer's disease in collaboration with Randy Nixon at NYU. So Randy has been looking at brains of patients for a long time and different models, and something that we have published is that there is an increase of autophagosomes in these models, and this is actually from a patient brain. So basically this is if you cut a neurite, so this will be the perimeter, and look what happened. This is a brain for Alzheimer's. It's completely, completely packed with these vesicles that then you purify, and they are really autophagosomes. So initially, when he showed me this picture, we were all excited, and he's like, you know, autophagy just went wild, and basically the cell is eating itself. Like, the neurons are just degrading, and eventually they die. So the only thing that we have to prove is protein degradation is enhanced because you have all these vacuoles degrading. However, we did those studies, and what we found was very different. We found that protein degradation, if anything, goes down. And we have done it with any single model of Alzheimer's that you can think of, with cells from patients, in different models. So basically, eventually, we found that there is an impairment in the ability to remove these autophagosomes. So basically, in normal conditions, when you form an autophagosome, from autophagosome till you get rid of this vesicle, it's about 5 to 10 minutes. So these compartments remain in the cell for very, very short periods of time, if everything is right. But then in this case, basically, these compartments were remaining for days. So there is a long lag in the removal, and then we have identified that there are both problems with fusion and then also with acidification itself. And in this case, it was particularly bad because APP, the protein that gets cleaved to produce the toxic peptide, was present in these vacuoles, as many other things, along with the protease that cleaves. So these vacuoles now become a source of A-beta. And when you put A-beta in the cytosol, it blocks fusion. So basically, you have a retrofeedback that prevents the clearance of these autophagosomes. So having that in mind, this idea that you have these conditions in which you have this huge amount of autophagosomes and your problem is that you cannot get rid of them, upregulation of macroautophagy might not be the answer because basically you are going to create more of these autophagosomes that are just going to start even hampering the conditions inside the cell worse. And the real solution should be to really upregulate the removal. But so far, there is not a very good way to enhance fusion of lysosomes. There is not enough known about the mechanism of this clearance, but this will be kind of like the therapeutic target. Find something that can get rid of these autophagosomes, and then, activate macroautophagy to keep the cell homeostasis, but not before because you are not going to get rid of them. So that was a note on the crosstalk and why these pathways are related. But basically, what I mentioned is that you go to this compensation stage in which, you know, you have your systems are not working so well, macroautophagy is taking over and maintaining everything on check. So why all of a sudden the cell fail? I mean, why we have the pathology or why you start having the loss, the neuronal loss? So there are, of course, as everything, there are many factors, and this is just a small picture of the big picture of Parkinson, but one of the things is that the activity of the systems can even further be decreased. And factors that contribute are, of course, oxidative stress or, for example, aging. So something that different groups, including ours, have reported is that the activity of chaperone-mediated and macroautophagy decrease with age. And if you remember, these are very late-onset diseases. So basically, you can be compensated for a while, but then when CMA and macro start to go down as you get old, the remaining activity is not enough, and eventually you might lead to this failure of the cell in addition to many other problems. But basically, the idea is that you have a multiple hit, as everything in Parkinson, that might also aggravate the situation. So we've been very interested in this part of the aging. I mean, what can we do? If we cannot activate our idea, our goal will be like to prevent these alpha synuclein for blocking this chaperone-mediated pathway. But at least if we can decrease the effect in aging, we might be able to maintain it longer. So we've been very interested in the effect of aging in the different autophagy pathways. And I'm just going to talk, we can talk in the discussion about macroautophagy, but just in CMA. So one of the things that we knew for a long time is that the activity of this pathway decreases with age, and actually the original evidence came from Palos Dai's lab. In fibroblasts in culture, we have the molecular players. He showed that all fibroblasts in passage, they have less ability to degrade this subset of proteins. And then basically, once we have the components, we can isolate lysosomes from YARN and all animals, and when you analyze how is the activity of translocation, it's clearly impaired with age. So then we engage in a very systematic analysis of what is wrong in aging. So initially we compare how is the efficiency of the chaperones. So if you take the chaperones from all animals, can they still present things to the lysosome? And they seem to be fine. I mean, most of our studies, we study different properties. They don't seem to be a major problem. The proteins make it to the membrane. But then we check the proteases inside, and the proteases are also okay. I mean, this is a particular group of lysosomes. The content of lipofuscin in these lysosomes is not very high, and besides, the capability is so high that they still can degrade. So most of the problem was located in the membrane. So we look at the chaperones in both sides. We look at this receptor or this LAMP2. And something that we notice is that when you compare the levels of this receptor in young and old animals, for example, these are lysosomes from a 3-month rat and a 22, and this is another pair. And as you can see, there is a dramatic decrease in the levels of this receptor as the animals get old, and we have old intermediated ages, suggesting that since this is the limiting step, I mean, you need your receptor in order to get these things across the membrane, this might be one of the major problems in the aging of the lysosome. So we've been trained to analyze why this decrease on the levels of the receptor with age. And one thing that we found is it's not transcriptional, so basically you still have the same expression. It's not problems with the splicing, that was another possibility because this is just a splice variant, but it seems to be a problem with the protein itself. You make this LAMP2, but then when it goes to the lysosomes, it's not so stable. So if you remember, and this is work from Roberta, I mentioned that LAMP2 normally has to come to these microdomains in the lysosomal membrane, and here is where it gets turnover. The cathepsin goes there, it gets cleaved, and then you have the renewal of your receptor. So this is the detergent resistant. We have imaging approaches, but basically you have a percent of your LAMP2 is always going there for renewal. When you look at the same, but in lysosomes from all animals, the protein basically never reach this area. So it kind of goes there, it doesn't really insert in these regions, and eventually it ends in the lumen and it gets rapidly degraded. So those low levels of LAMP2 that we have in the old lysosomes are mostly due to instability of this protein. So, of course, part of what we want to do now is trying to look for stabilizers or try to figure out what is the changes, and we really think that there are changes in the lipids, in the characteristics of these lipid microdomains with age that are important to prevent this turnover. But independently of that, I mean, even we don't know exactly why the protein becomes unstable, we thought that we could try to repair. I mean, at least we have something that decreases. So our naive approach was let's put back this receptor or let's maintain this receptor till very late in life and see if if this can maintain the activity of this pathway and whether or not this is any good for the cells. So something that sounds like a very straightforward project became, of course, a very long project, and the brave graduate student that just got it published now and finally graduate, Judy San, was the big hero behind this, because Judy decided to do this in animals, in mouse model, but then we have to do it as a bi-transgenic. We wanted to have control of the expression, and the idea is that she's going to have this extra copy of LAMP2 that in the presence of doxycycline is going to be repressed, and then when you remove doxycycline, you will have your extra copy activated. And I'm just going to show the results in liver because the expression in other tissues, the animals have not reached the age. They are still very young. But these are the ones that really make it to late age. So basically, we wanted to have this control of the receptor. This was important for us because when we look how the levels of this receptor change with age, so the levels really don't decrease till the animals are 9 to 10 months old, and then it starts going down pretty gradual. So the whole idea is that if we do a regular transgenic and we have LAMP2 from very early in life, we are going to have an overexpressor. And of course, you will start with very high levels here, and that could change many other things. And that was not our question. Our question was, if we prevent this decline, is this any good for the cells? I mean, how much this contributes to the aging of the organ? So the whole idea was to wait till these animals are 10 months old, and then basically we remove the repression. So then you're going to have your extra transgene is now going to start to produce. So we did that, and of course we verified that at 22, 26 months, that was our endpoint, the lysosomal levels that are not higher than when they were young, but they are at these levels. We have to play a little with the dose, but we finally got it. And then these lysosomes that have this LAMP2 was functional. When you compare the functionality of the lysosomes from the old animals, these guys, with animals that are younger, they are functioning well and much better than these guys. So then we start thinking, okay, is this of any good for the cells? In this case, from hepatocytes in liver. So I made the big argument that we think that this pathway is important for the removal of oxidized proteins. So the idea was, let's look at oxidized proteins in these animals and see what happened. So we took liver from those animals, and of course, if you compare Jan and all, and this is just basically a bidimensional gel of cytosolic proteins that we have probed for carbonyl groups. So you are detecting oxidized proteins. So if you compare wild type when there are 6 months compared to when there are 22, you can see the amount of garbage oxidized proteins that these animals are accumulating. So the question was basically, are our animals, those ones that we have maintained CMA stable for a long time, do they look like this, or something in the middle? And basically what we found was this. So we were very excited about this because it's really a dramatic improvement in the accumulation of oxidized proteins. And I don't want to make it long, but we have a second group that we activated later on, and they don't improve as much, but they are still definitely better than the wild type. So even late in life, you still have the chances of removing or preventing the accumulation. And the same thing, we look at oxidized proteins, we look at aggregated proteins, so we follow them by ubiquitin. So in young hepatocytes, you find very few aggregates. When you are old, all animals have bigger aggregates and more. And then our animals, they have lower number of aggregates, and they are also smaller. We also look for the pigment, the typical marker of aging, that is lipofuscin, because as you know, these are undegraded products that accumulate inside lysosomes. So when we do, this is just liver section, you look under the microscope, and this is autofluorescent pigment. So when the animals are old, they accumulate all these autofluorescent granules that I hope you can see. When you see our animals, 26 months, basically you can hardly see any lipofuscin. And then we also wanted, since I mentioned that we think that this pathway is important during stress, we challenge the animals. We haven't challenged them much because we didn't have many initially, so now we are doing more things to them. But at least we have some results with hepatotoxic compounds, and then see how they respond with cellular death. So with the same compound that in young cells does not produce cell death, in the old liver you have all these apoptotic bodies because you are damaging these cells. When you do the same compound in our animals, basically you hardly have, the levels of cell death are less, suggesting that the cell is better prepared for this stress. So basically, so far, what I have showed you is that if you maintain chaperone-mediated autophagy till late in life, you have a cleaner liver, so it's a liver that doesn't have so much aggregation, oxidized proteins, and it responds better to stress. But is this improving function? All the idea about aging studies, you want to recover function, not just to have clean organs. So we analyze the function, and being in a liver center, they help us with many tests, but the one that we really like is this one, that basically is the removal of a muscle relaxant. So as you know, one of the major functions of the liver is to remove any kind of drugs. So we took one drug that has been well characterized to be removed by liver, and it happens to be a muscle relaxant. So you put your animals, you inject them, and then basically they get immobilized. And then you just have to count how long does it take for them to start running again, and that gave us an idea how good the liver is taking this. So basically when we do that, if you get young animals in 1 hour and a half that are running like crazy, if you do it in the old animals, it takes double the time, and some of them are not even able to clear up this compound and eventually die. We didn't want to kill them, but using the same doses that in the young ones, they die. And then the idea was, okay, this clean liver, does it function better? So when we measure clearance time, and this is after early activation of this pathway or late, you still have a very dramatic improve in liver function. So the whole idea of where are we heading right now, we really would like to convert all these old brooms in functional and new ones, and we are doing different approaches. So regarding the one of the major questions is, why is LAMP2 unstable? This is a proof of principle work. We just put an extra gene, and now you can maintain the whole thing, but you are not going to be doing gene therapy in 50-year-old people. So basically the whole idea is that we want to find ways to stabilize this protein or to understand better why it's not stable anymore. So in collaboration with Rafael de Cabo, we started to look at changes in the lipid composition of the lysosomal membrane with age, and in this particular lipid microdomains. So he's doing lipidomics, and we are trying to figure out what proteins are there. So hopefully we will have a better feeling of why this protein cannot be be recruited to those regions and being removed and normally turnover. We are also want to explore a little more this idea of the crosstalk, because as I mentioned, you have this compensation stage in which you can really use the activity of the other pathways. And even the land to animal has also better macroautophagy. So there is enough crosstalk among these pathways that can be explored in the future. And then the other thing that we really want to do is try to do similar approach in other tissues. So my future is basically surrounded by mice right now, but they came in different flavors. So basically, as I mentioned, we have this albumin one that is the one that I presented today that is modifying CMA in liver, and we think that we can still explore that one a little more in the context of the metabolic syndrome of aging, because there is a good evidence of this crosstalk between liver and adipose tissue and lipid metabolism. So we are currently right now doing some studies on lipid metabolism and glucose metabolism in those animals with a better functional liver. But then also we are very interested we have these animals now, but as I said, they are very young, that is targeted to neurons. If we can do something similar in neurons, we think that this could be relevant for the removal of some of these misbehaving proteins that we were talking in Parkinson. And then finally, we also want to have, and we have it now, an overexpressor in all the tissues, because if we found that this decrease with age of LAMP2A seems to be very universal. There are tissues that decrease more than others, but it seems to be always on the low side. So the whole idea is that, you know, if you restore one organ, I'm not sure those animals, you are going to increase the health span and of these animals as they get old. But if you attack critical systems, you might be able to do that. So the whole idea is that we want to restore at least the quality control mechanism regarding degradation in different tissues. And then I'm not as interested of whether these animals live longer or not, because I'm going to have to pay for the housing. So it's okay that they don't live too long, but as far as they are healthy. So the whole idea is actually we are more interested in the functional aspects. It's like, are you maintaining better function of all the organs and tissues just by improving the intracellular environment? Because it's kind of a chain. I mean, because the cells have a better environment, we test mitochondrial function is also better. I mean, you are not floating in garbage, so you should function better. So we think that this concept can be extrapolated. And then, as I mentioned, I mean, all these gene approaches, just putting this extra copy of LAMP2 is just a proof of principle. But what we really want to do is try to use other interventions that will contribute to stabilize this receptor at the lysosomal membrane as the animals get old. And we are doing some diet manipulations because the changes that I mentioned in the lipid composition. So I think I mentioned everybody as I went. The lab is a little bigger, so I put in red the people that I talk about then during the talk. And then all this work is only possible because we are extremely lucky to have terrific collaborators. So Fred Dice, my always mentor at Tufts University, the work on HSP90 was in collaboration with Lua here. We have the crosstalk with Noburu Mizushima. Then we have all the neurodegeneration team that has been essential to move all this. And then this is the people that gave us the money, mostly NAA, because of the interest in aging. So thank you very much for your attention, and I will be happy to take questions.
So if there are any questions, actually while we're waiting, I had a question.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that when CMA decreases, macroautophagies increase. Do you have any insight into the signaling pathway that's used to do that?
So we've been looking at that because we think that if we can find the modulators of the crosstalk, then we can manipulate them directly and don't have to block CMA to upregulate macro. So we've been looking in different aspects. One of them, it has been mostly focused in HSC70, so the chaperone that is inside the lysosomes is essential to get the translocation. So we thought that, you know, this might be one of the molecules that if you don't have macro, so what we have found in that crosstalk is that when you don't have macro, so this is the opposite. So if you don't have macro, why CMA goes up? We are a little closer on that. So what we found is that if you don't have macro autophagy, autophagosomes don't fuse with lysosomes, obviously, so you don't have fluctuations in pH. And fluctuations in pH are very important to maintain the stability of this chaperone. So they can keep doing CMA and they will maintain higher levels. And then in the reverse direction, what we have been looking is that some of these ATGs, so these are essential proteins for the formation of the autofagosome, they contain the CMA targeting motif. So when you don't have CMA, the levels of those proteins go up because you cannot remove them. I mean, you don't have the normal. So the half-life has increased, and some of them are not essential, but some of them are critical, as you know, to now form autofagosomes. So we think that by default you are forming more autofagosomes just because you have more ATGs in the cytosol. But we still have to work out. I'm pretty sure there are kinases and signaling mechanisms that we will have to look at.
That was a fascinating story. I'm curious about the actual protein transport process with the lamp.
Yeah.
You've got very little membrane protein associated, it seemed, from what you were showing, but you're accomplishing this rather remarkable task of pulling lipid in across a bilayer. Are there any other proteins? In other words, is lamp independent, doesn't need any other membrane proteins to accomplish this task, or is there more to the complex than just the conjunction of those different lamps?
Yeah, so that's a very critical question. So the whole thing is that, as I mentioned, when we got LAMP2, we thought it's like we are going to pull down all these 7 span transmembrane proteins that are going to be the transporters. So pull downs, forget it, because the cytosolic tail is what we have to use because it's the specific one, and then if the substrate is there, there goes your tail. But we did different approaches, and we couldn't find that. So then we decided to go the mitochondria approach. It's like, okay, what is the minimal component? Can we put LAMP2 in liposomes and get it to transport? So we put it in liposomes, and of course, initially it didn't transport, of course, but then we realized we need the chaperone inside. So if you do liposomes, that you put HSC70 inside, and then you put this LAMP2, purified LAMP2 in the membrane, you get translocation. It's very inefficient. So, and then if you put the mutants that cannot multimerize, you don't get it. But I didn't want to publish that part of the project yet, because the caveat here is that we are using LAMP2 that we cannot purify from bacteria or yeast, because this is heavily, heavily glycosylated, very light level. So if we use that one, it's very unstable. So we have to purify it from mammal cells. And of course, even mass spec doesn't reveal contamination from other proteins. We might have femtomoles of the transporter, and that's the guy that is doing the job. So I can tell you we need multimerization of LAMP2. I'm still looking for another component there. We have now some modulators, but most of them seem in both sides of the membrane. We don't have that, but so far that's as far as we go on that.
If you look at the same age of different cells in the body, say muscle, liver, mm-hmm. and brain, is brain cells more susceptible to the LAMP2 effect than other cells?
So that's a very important, and we kind of starting now. I mean, we've been a liver lab for a long time, so we've been looking now a lot in brain. So, for example, if the age-dependent effect in brain is very region-dependent. So, for example, dopaminergic neurons, cortical neurons, and cholinergic neurons, they have very low levels as they age. Astrocytes, they seem to maintain good levels. So we kind of want to use astrocytes to figure out what are they doing good to maintain the stability of LAMP2. But we haven't looked systematically in other tissues. So we have kidney also decrease. We have in heart. We have now macrophages, dendritic cells. Dendritic cells is actually very dramatic decrease. But it seems to be that there is some tissue dependence, and our idea is to use the tissues that are doing better and see how they do. But it might also be very well related with the normal basal levels of this pathway, depending on the tissue. So we have to look at that.
So we have to accept our fate. Going back to LAMP2A, mm-hmm. for certain proteins, for binding to membrane, they need some alkylation, isoprenylation, and things like that. You think that might happen for LAMP2?
So we were looking at that, and that's because this protein is transmembrane, but we were looking for some modifications of LAMP2. So in the cytosolic tail, because, you know, the lumen is common for all the LAMP2, so we thought that has to be something specific there. So we couldn't find that there was a region of phosphorylation, but we couldn't find it phosphorylated. We've been trained. We mutate it. It doesn't seem to affect. There is, however, a 4 positive residues. There is a stretch of positive residues in the cytosolic tail that if we take out, there is not binding anymore. But we are really, I mean, so far isoprenylation didn't work. So any kind of modification that we look so far didn't work. But we are still looking what is bringing it to the microdomains, which kind of modification. So far seems to be more protein-protein interaction. So in the microdomains, we find LAMP2 interacting with some proteins that is not outside of those microdomains, but there could be also some modifications that we haven't identified. But that's a very important post-translational changes in this protein. Yeah.
As far as aging is concerned, are you familiar with the work of Bruce Ames and alpha lipoic acid and this other amino acid as far as transport of fatty acids across mitochondrial membranes?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether or not LAMP2A viability might be enhanced by trying that particular protocol.
Yeah, so actually I've been talking with Bruce. We were in LA the other day because I think that will be very interesting. So we are looking for things like that. Right now, the approach that we are doing is boutique screen of molecule compounds. So it's compounds that are going to modify on that area. I mean, changes in lipid composition. So we are testing just to see changes in the activity of this pathway, still in young cells. And the idea will be, as you point out, then translate it to all cells, change do these modifications in the lipids in lysosomes and see if that helps. But that's a compound that I really would like to put
because
my hands on.
That might be involved in reducing the oxidative burden.
Exactly, because, I mean, it has to be some kind of modification in the lipids. I mean, the lipidomic assay, it's going to tell us something, but you might still have some modifications that we might miss. So I think if we can prevent them. So if we prevent, for example, oxidative stress, LAMP2 is a little more stable, but how long can you keep that? So we are looking for things that we can target specifically. Yeah, that's very important.
So I just want to remind you that there's a reception outside in the atrium where you can chat with Anna Maria some further. And thank you for the presentation.